PhD on sort of ethnobotanical aspects of Lisu in northern Thailand. And this is the just some little bits that I covered in that PhD. Having seen other presentations, I'm wondering whether I should go on for different aspects, but here we go anyway. So I'm just going to briefly outline the research project that I did, and then do a bit of a run-through of the Lisu folk taxonomy that I found, and also what's probably a bit more related to the themes of this conference, metonymy and metaphor in Lisu plant names. So the Lisu language is Tibeto-Burman. There are three main dialects, but there's a couple of others that are a little bit different, that aren't mutually intelligible. There's a couple of scripts that are now in use, sort of post-missionary days, but here we use a Fraser script. There are more than 1 million speakers, so it's not an endangered language. It's quite vital in a lot of ways, but still small. The thing that is dropping off, though, is the transfer of traditional plant knowledge. So not a lot of the young people are interested. They're more interested in going to towns and cities for education and for work and things like that. So, and it is a traditional sort of plant transfer society, so you need to have a young person that's studying with an older person over a period of time. It's not so, you know, just, oh, we use this for this and this for this. So there's a map of where my field sites were, Doi Lan and Khun Kong, just in northern Thailand there. Lisu plant use, they are mainly farmers these days, so they're farming mostly rice and corn, but also cabbage and cucumber, and more recently coffee has come up as a cash crop. I'm not sure how that's going for them. They were just starting when I was there in 2012 and 2013. But also there's still a lot of people, certainly older people, foraging for food and medicines from the forest, and also just on the edges of the fields there's quite a lot of plants that are useful. There's a shaman in the village who use plants for spiritual things like rituals. Also whiskey making is a big thing there. Use lots of, like, up to 7 or 8 plants to make the whiskey taste good. I don't know if I agree that it tastes good, but and then there's also exchanging various varieties of plants with other ethnic groups and sort of keeping those going, and also social interactions with other groups like the Aka and Lahu and Karen in the same area. So already we can see the plants are related to spiritual traditions and physical well-being of the people that use them. So just a couple of pictures of some hill farming, there we go, terrace farming. And that's two different villages I've just shown you there. As you can see, there's quite a lot of deforestation happening, but that's not necessarily just the hill tribe's fault. There's a lot of reasons behind that that I can't go into today with time restrictions. This is one of my translators on the left-hand picture, and some of my consultants. As you can see, we're pressing the plants there. Another of my translators and now very good friend, Mimi, who lives in Chiang Mai but goes up to her village quite frequently, who's very involved in things there. And another consultant, Mimi's aunt, who's shown they're collecting some plants just outside of a field. So the project that I did, so I'm going to go through this very quickly. I did informal walks around villages and recorded the Lisu plant names and uses, both audio and transcribed them as best I could. I took notes on all the information and took a lot of photographs and some video when I could. It's a bit hard just being one person. Pressed and dried the samples and recorded the GPS of where I found them. And I sort of based my theory in linguistic, anthropological, and botanical practices. And then once I had the dried plants, I actually also did some cognitive sorting activities to see how people classify plants into different groupings. So what kind of plant is this? Do these plants belong together? Or would you put them in different groups? And you can see there on the bottom photo that we're doing those sorting activities there. So that was the second trip. I've also collected a lot of extra data that isn't relevant to today's talk, but has a lot of applications outside of what I've already done. So I've got some extended narratives involving plant names, got a lot of uses, including quite a lot of medicinal uses, and I did get the scientific identifications for most of the 300 or so plants that I collected via a botanist. I'm not a botanist. Last year I returned a photo book with a selection of the plants, like photo written names, but also a CD that matches up to the plants so that they can hear them. They don't tend to have TVs or DVDs up there, so it's kind of limited to paper and audio. And I've still got other ideas for that data to go back at some point as well. Some considerations when I was collecting the plants. So mostly Sue are either animist or Christian. The animistly Sue believe that if they show you a plant and you're the wrong person, i.e. an outsider, as I was, if they show you the plant, it may not ever be found again, or it may lose its effectiveness. So that's a pretty serious consequence if they tell you the wrong thing. But the Christian Lisu do not hold this belief, so they were actually a lot more forthcoming with information. But then I suppose there's that aspect of, you know, if the animus find that out, you know, I don't know how that interplay would happen, because I went to two separate villages and got that information from two separate places. So it's just something to think about. And then of course is, how do the villages' intellectual property get protected? At the moment I haven't released my thesis online, so I'm still thinking about that. And also the dried plants are stored in a herbarium. As someone raised in an earlier session today, there's issues with genetic stuff there, so people get hold of the genetic material, they might misuse it, like Westerners, I mean. So it might be that I should prevent loans on that collection, or think about something along those lines. And the GPS coordinates, as I said, have been taken, but they're not included in the thesis itself, although they are technically attached to the plant specimens. So it's not something I'll be including with the thesis, but again, that's another issue. If people could go off and find that genetic material in the field by themselves without consulting the community, that is a big problem. So the folk taxonomy, got a scientific taxonomy, which probably most of you have seen before, just from the highest to the lowest, so from the plant kingdom right down to the species. And then folk taxonomy is a similar idea. You've just got the unique beginner. In this case, we're just looking at plants. And then life forms, so sort of the larger groupings like trees or vines or grasses. Intermediates, so a little bit controversial. They are often covert, according to Berlin. The generics are the most commonly known name of a plant, so corn, and then I've given examples of specifics which tend to be culturally important plants, so they get sort of broken up into smaller groupings, and then varietals are even smaller again. In Lisu, word for plant kingdom as a unique beginner, we did come up with this Sidzalidza term, but some speakers use it, some don't. Everyone understands the concept of the plant kingdom, but some people will name it and some people won't. This may have come out of the Bible because of all the missionary work, so it's unclear whether that's actually valid for everyone. Well, I'd say it's not valid for everyone. Also, just as a side note, for animals, there's no corresponding word at all, so that's also interesting. Life forms. We had, so this is like such a quick run through of this, but a bunch of names came up as we did the plant collecting, and these were the names. So you've got trees, vines, and things like that. Yipo is an interesting one because it doesn't really correspond to an English life form, so it's something coming from a central point and going outwards, so often like bunches of grass, but we'll come back to that in a second. weeds are pretty similar to that little herbaceous weeds sort of ideas. Vegetable came up, which is not really about plant morphology, but use, so that's another thing that will come up again. And grass came up as a life form as well. So we've got Yipo and Shi. Just keeping those in mind as we look at some more names. In another session, I ended up getting these longer form names, which sound the same, but actually, most of the time they do refer to the same plants, but sometimes a couple of them would move groups. So Tsetse Lhotse may or may not include the Yidse group, which they should be synonymous, but they're actually not. But again, I don't have quite the time to go through that in great detail, but you can ask me that afterwards. So basically I had a whole bunch of names. Some were short, some were long, some looked like they should be the same, but they weren't necessarily. And then you also had issues of which life form is this one, for example. So here, this is Penicetum polystachyon, and it comes out from a central point, so it's considered a Yipo that we just covered before. But then when I took it to plant sorting, it looks like this, and it was considered Shi. So Yipo was that one, and Shi is grass. So it's considered both, but in the field it's Yipo because it's growing in that shape. But when it's in plant sorting, it's in this shape, just in a strand, so it's considered grass. So there's the issue of multiple categories depending on what you're looking at the time. So that was also interesting and somewhat unexpected given Berling's theories. So in the end, after a lot of discussion, that I also won't go into now, we came up with the ones in bold as the overarching groupings for life forms. I would say that I haven't tested it amongst lots of different groups. I didn't have time in my field research. You may come up with different answers in different villages. I think that's very possible. And I'm not too sure how influenced by biblical sort of terms that have come up in the Bible for plants and things like that, how influenced these groupings are. Because also that the one for climber and vine didn't come up in any other discussions we had except for this final exploration of the life forms. So the life forms are definitely recognised in Lisu, but they're not immutable properties, they can change. And it might be worth thinking about it in terms of cognitive prototypes. Intermediates, they are supposed to be plants that are morphologically similar to each other, but the Lisu people group plants into use-based categories. They weren't really interested at this level in morphologically similar plants. So we had those as a bunch of uses, which actually goes against Berling's theory. He disagrees with use-based categories. However, Hum in 1982 talked about them as a thing that he believed existed. So there's a bit of confusion over the theory there, which I'm just going to leave at that point. Then we also have generics. I don't really have time to play all the names, but generics, if you remember, are the basic name of a plant that most kids will learn when they're growing up. So you've got things like goat beard and curly grass, female buffalo horn reversed. You can see in the picture that there's like a horn. So these are all getting into what we'll talk about next, which is the metaphor and metonymy. So a brief summary of the Berling folk taxonomy. Most of them can sort of be found in Lisu, but maybe not exactly as Berling wanted them to be. So Berling's theory, he presents it as rules rather than tendencies. So my findings were that for Lisu, at least, the Berling's theory is tendencies, not rules. So in that way, adds to that theory. And then moving on, because I'm running out of time, onto the metaphor and metonymy. So a lot of the plant names use metaphor or metonymy, and there's some definitions of them, if we're not familiar. This has been explored before by Turpin in 2013, who looked at metaphor and metonymy in Polissinus plant names and animal names in Kaitech. And she found there was visual metaphor and a whole bunch of metonymy types. And I found in Lisu something very similar. So there's a lot of visual metaphors, and many of them are based on animal body parts, and also a lot more types of metonymy. So 173 of those 300 plant names appear to include some kind of metonymy or metaphor, so it's, you know, more than half. And of course the examples that I have are based on what the plant consultants can tell me about them, because I don't speak Lisu. I'm obviously not a native speaker. So the metaphor types that I found, just visual only, and we'll have a look at a couple in a second. And the metonymy I found visual, behavioural, sensory, use and effect was a big one again that obviously came up a lot of times in the data. Spatial, kin-based, plants that refer to other ethnic groups, and then a special case that I will make sure we get time to look at. So the first one, Alumetsu pot soot tree, refers to, so it's a colour metaphor, not actually just using the word black, but basically the when the bark burns it becomes black, and that's what they're referring to. So it looks similar to pot soot, so it's called pot soot tree. Then we have the orphan comb, which actually relates to a story, a very brief story, where apparently sometime in the past there was an orphan who didn't have a comb, so he used this for his hair instead. I'm not sure how stiff and how well that would go, but there's obviously a lot of names linked to stories as well, some of which I've collected, and there's still more work to be done on that. Straight up visual ones. The red medicine example there actually is interesting. I'm still not clear on which part of the plant is red. I believe it's the roots, but the medicine comes up as a category almost of its own. And then you've got hairy thorn, which is a type of raspberry. And then we've got behavioural, which is quite interesting. So shy weed, when you touch the leaves of some mimosas, they actually fold up. Got some nods. So that's why they call that shy weed, because it's like hiding. And then you've also got night flower, which only flowers at night time, so just observations of behaviour becoming the name of the plant. And then we've got some others. The taste, I did actually taste that, and it is extremely sour. So just describing that. Mei Chang, I'm sure some of you will be familiar with Mei Chang oil, so that's just called wood aromatic tree. And then the use, the bee feeling faint tree, they use the wood and burn it to sedate the bees when they're collecting honey from other trees. And the effect, we couldn't actually collect that specimen because no one was willing to go near it because it makes them so itchy. So I don't actually know what species that is, but certainly have the name there. So medicine, as I said, did come up a lot of times. I have a lot of medicinal data, and I'm hoping to present that at some point in the near future, because that's quite a comprehensive database of that. And just giving a few names there. And then there's another four types that I don't have time to go into today, but there's one that references sound, the sound of a dog bell. Again, I feel like that might relate to a story, or more than it may or may not be metonymy. It's hard to know without more information on that one. And then finally, this special case. There was only one of these, but then there's only one of these plants that we came across. So it's a type of mistletoe, so it's an epiphyte, and it grows on trees without proper roots. And the story of this, so the name we've got, Titi, which is a specific kind of bird, which unfortunately I wasn't able to identify what kind it is, but it's a specific kind of bird, creeping around trees, wood, and untidy. So what that's actually trying to describe is the story of how it propagates. So it's an epiphyte, it only grows in other trees. Its method of reproduction is by a specific kind of bird eating its fruit, and then the seed needs to land on a preferred kind of tree via the bird droppings, and then it grows. So it's referencing the role of that specific bird in the life cycle, and also where the plant's found and what it looks like, because, well, that's what the consultants told me, that, you know, it looks messy, and that's why that's part of the name. So that was a really interesting example. And also just in terms of the folk taxonomy with that plant, they instantly said it was unclassifiable. Let's tie back into the taxonomy. So it's known as a very different kind of plant to the other kinds. And so we can see, sorry, it's such a whirlwind tour, but you can see that all sorts of information can be encoded in the leafy plant names. I mean, a common reason for this is that in a non-literate society, it can help peat speakers store and remember information about the uses of plants. And just in terms of the sort of amount and types of metonymy and metaphor that I found, it does roughly match those of Turpin. She found some slightly different ones to me, and vice versa. And it would be nice to get some comparisons across some other languages. Implications. I undertook the project to hopefully record some of the plant information for the communities. That was kind of my, obviously besides doing my PhD, was trying to give that information back to the community. So I'm still trying to figure out the best way to do that. The community has given me permission to put it on a website, but I'm not sure that they understand exactly what that might mean. The older people might not understand because they don't know, they've never used the internet, they don't know what it is. The younger people, of course, do know, but they don't have that sort of attachment to the knowledge as well. So just some things I'm still thinking about, and also how to get the community involved in adding to the plant knowledge or using it, and what is the most valuable format for them. I've mentioned an app when I spoke here 2 years ago, still no closer to making that, but that's still an idea. And just finally, acknowledgements, lots of people to thank, some references, and also a bonus slide of my friend Mindy, who does a lot of work on these handicrafts, so if you're interested in that aspect, you can go visit those pages as well. Thank you.
We have about 8 minutes for questions.
Oh, I think you see.
Does the language have a classifier system or a learning system? Because when the plant has the two names for the one that is growing like that, as opposed to the blade that is like, it looks like a classifier thing. Or some of the other things could also be metonymies.
Apparently, so I worked with David Bradley, who is an expert on Leesu, and I talked to him about classifiers, and he assures me that it's not an actual official classifier system that we're looking at here. So, but then they are sort of in the sense of classifying the plant types, of course they are, but in a sort of language sense they're not. So, yeah, don't know actually, yeah.
Because all those pieces of metonymy, not all of them, but many of them look like metonymic systems too.
Yeah, I definitely look into that further because I haven't looked at this data for a little while.
The second part is you have a picture of a guy with a big leaf. And in some of the cases that I've looked at, big leaves are another subcategory. So within the categorization that you have, where do these
That was a banana leaf.
Yeah,
so bananas are actually a separate category again because of their use more so than the leaf size. Yeah, that's how that was explained to me. He was just using that as an umbrella actually in that photo. But yeah.
So bananas are the only ones that have those big leaves?
We didn't collect anything. Oh, there's a couple of bigger leafed things. And they went under Setzelitza, which is the tree category. Yeah, so the bananas were definitely explained to me as being separate, but because they're bananas, not because of their big leaves or any other aspect. But they're still Yidza in terms of they've got a long stem. But if you, actually the story for that was If someone says to go and clear all the sitzelitze in a field, they'll actually leave the banana trees because they're a different category. So, yeah. I haven't thought about that. My initial feeling on that is that maybe not possible. Partly because it's in the tropics, which makes things a little tricky. I could talk to Mimi about that.
There's nice work by Jeanette Piper.
Mm-hmm.
Worked in Indonesia on developing community of variants. Might be one possible solution and also address some of the intellectual property issues that you bring up as well.
Are you thinking of the plants I've already collected or the one, like, get them to collect more? Because the problem with collecting more is the drying. So, if you get them to Chiang Mai like I did, then that might be possible to get them dry and then take them back up. Yeah, I'd definitely have to ask Mimi about that one because she would be the conduit probably for that. Yeah, good idea though, thank you. Yes.
Just because I'm interested in you or had to give it the time, you had in the one of the last few slides something about metonymic names that were based on like other ethno-linguistic groups.
Yes.
What, like, do you have an example of that?
So there's one plant name that's something along the lines of Lahu female wrapped cloth tree. So I didn't get to the bottom of what those were because there were only like three or four of them. I suspect that, so that in the hills, in the mountains up there, those hill tribes live quite closely together with each other, and often even sort of in the same village nowadays. So I don't know if that's sort of, they've observed that community using that plant for something in particular, or if it relates to a story. I still don't know that one, unfortunately. But
yeah, I was wondering, like in my own stuff, I've seen examples of, other groups named as part of a plant name, and it's kind of like instead of encoding how how these people use the plant, it's encoding how somebody else uses the plant, but we don't use it that way.
Yeah, I'd have to go back to my database and see whether the use that they have for it is the same as the other ethnic group. I can think of like there's a plant called like Old People Chili, which is still used as a spice, but not very often. So my feeling is that they do tend to refer to their own uses of stuff, so yeah, I have to follow that one up. Yeah. Oh, yes?
I just wonder if there are any recently introduced plants that are not part of the traditional knowledge, and if so, how do they go about classifying?
So there's things like cacti up there, and again, they're not classified. Those in particular weren't classified. There are things like, I saw, what's it called? Plantain, but not the, the little herb plantain. Plantain major, I think it was, which I know from Western herbal medicine. But they would still classify it as a weed, like a herbaceous weed, but they didn't have a name for it. So if it looks similar to things that they've already classified, I think they go with that classification, but may not have a name because they don't use that for anything at all. It's, I pointed it out and they're like, okay.
Given what you found here in terms of classification and all that we know about usage-based categories in other languages and covert categories,
mm-hmm.
what do you think the utility of the
I think it's useful as a starting framework. It's actually where I started. This was my proposal, was to do a folk taxonomy, and then it sort of branched outwards. I think in the longer term, I'm not sure how useful it is. It can be, I think as a framework, it's okay. And then you sort of, if you're not, as long as you're not trying to squeeze your data into that framework, because I don't think in any way. Like, even in his own data, he put little footnotes, and he's like, oh, it's not always like that, though. So I don't think even for Berlin it was that strict. So, yeah, if you're into sort of theoretical frameworks, it's useful. Beyond that, maybe not particularly. Yeah, I gave back a photo book with audio CDs, so...
What was the reception?
Good, I think they don't react very much. They're just, certainly, my translators were excited and happy, and I took extra copies for them. I don't know whether there's really the interest, you know, it's hard, and it's not something I can... You know, if they're not sort of interested in building up or transferring that knowledge, that's not up to me to decide that. So, yeah. Yes.
But I've discussed in the work that we have done this thing about how to return to the community books or herbariums. It's kind of silly, I have to say, because we build a herbarium when we are 3,000 miles from those specimens, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they just go out and get it.
Yeah.
Which
is actually better than the dried, in
the
terms of...
The dried that loses the color, loses the texture,
totally.
Who recognizes the real plant out of that? You have to be trained in a certain way to do that.
Yeah, they did extremely well with the sowing activities. It was,
So, I mean, when you look at you, it's like, it's like going to your kitchen, taking pictures of your kitchen, making a photo book. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It does, I mean, we are some... I think that sometimes we are so wrapped up in what academia does that we lose perspective of what the point of it is.
Yeah, I think my interest would be getting the, like with an app or something, and sharing knowledge between younger people, just getting that interest back in it more than having a static. I mean, a static record is useful if down the line people are like, oh, I wonder, you know, what they used and how they used it. Like, it's useful in that sense, but yeah, in terms of real-time interest, I agree. It's, yeah.